okay, so you have a guy in his 50s. He had acute pancreatitis 2 years ago, right? And he's also had 1 to 3 hour episodes of severe abdominal pain since then. And they don't tell you how many, but what they are communicating is that he's had recurrent acute pancreatitis that's self-resolved, right? And in turn, this leads to chronic pancreatitis. And chronic pancreatitis is characterized by oftentimes normal pancreatic enzyme levels. You're like, oh, wow, like they're normal. Really? Yeah. Same thing when you have like hepatic cirrhosis, you can get normal liver enzymes. So the organ will burn out. So it decreases enzyme production. That's a good factoid to know. That's why your lipase/amylase would be normal here in chronic pancreatitis.
And when it burns it out?
The organ will burn out. Okay. That's how you colloquially describe it. That the organ will undergo repeated bouts of tissue damage and eventually become hyposecretory in the sense of the pancreas. Now this guy has steatorrhea. They could have asked you for, rather than just the diagnosis of pancreatic insufficiency or chronic pancreatitis, they could have said, what's the next best step? And it would have been pancreatic enzyme supplementation or pancrealipase. That's an answer I've seen on one of the exams. They literally had pancrealipase listed. So you have to just give him enzymes. That's how you treat this. But do you understand that this was chronic pancreatitis?
I do. I think I was initially thinking that. And then the ferritin level.
Ferritin's fine. So the thing is, they tell you his ferritin level is 250 nanograms per milliliter. And this is the harder component because, you know, I guess you'd have to look in the lab values, but I can tell you it's actually pretty standard to know that hemochromatosis is diagnosed when your ferritin is 300 or greater in the setting of somebody who has signs/symptoms of hemochromatosis, generally just signs, like the hyperpigmentation or the increased sugar levels or something like pseudogout or cardiomyopathy, right? Greater than 300 in men and postmenopausal women, and it's greater than it's greater than 200 in menstruating women. Now, just to be clear, the USMLE will always give you greater than 300, no matter what, even in a woman who's menstruating, if they happen to go that route, they'll give you greater than 300.
Gotcha. Okay.
Okay. So this is where the training wheels come off, because like I know your situation's unique where you're doing step one prep and your surgery shelf concurrently. So it's understandable that you're not going to just have all these values memorized. The tricky part about step two assessment is that the training wheels have to come off where you see a question like this with all these values, you're like, holy shit. But if you have them memorized, like if you know the values, then this isn't hard, right? Like you can just...
From the lab values that they do provide, I think it was up to 200 for ferritin, which is why I was thinking, oh, then this seems a little bit higher. But okay.
Yeah. So you could say it's elevated, but it's not hemochromatosis level.
Yeah. Okay.
They're going to give you greater than 300 for hemochromatosis, but hemochromatosis is high yield for surgery as well. And you just need, if they do give you a diagnosis of hemochromatosis, a vignette of it, the answer might not just be straight up hemochromatosis. The answer might be increased intestinal absorption of iron. Yeah. That's the mechanism. Okay.
Okay.
Autosomal recessive.
You talked about choice A. I think it was a
blind loop syndrome. There's blind loop syndrome. Is that what you're referring to? Well, bacterial overgrowth refers to blind loop syndrome. So, yeah, it's weird. So blind loop syndrome can occur as a result of previous surgery, or it can just be idiopathic. And you essentially get an area in the small bowel where the passage of digestive contents sort of, quote unquote, miss that area. It's almost like that area is not cleared properly. And you can get bacterial overgrowth there, and that can lead to symptoms like diarrhea. But they call this blind loop syndrome.
Okay.
Okay, something to be aware of. Not the highest yield, but it has a tendency of showing up sometimes. Where you're like, oh, I've seen that. What is that? Like blind loop syndrome. Same thing as dumping syndrome, actually. Dumping syndrome, classically following gastric bypass. But dumping syndrome is going to show up where you get diarrhea, but it's going to be often in the setting of hypoglycemia. Because when you get hyperosmolar chyme from the stomach entering the small bowel too quickly, that can cause a spike in insulin, and precipitate hypoglycemia in addition to diarrhea. Now, if you were to go on like Wikipedia and start reading about dumping syndrome, you'll see that there's actually different types, and they don't really get into that degree of specificity. It's more you just need to be aware that like there's something called dumping syndrome. It'll occur following gastric bypass sometimes, and you can get hypoglycemia and diarrhea. Whereas blind loop syndrome, you can get diarrhea. It can occur following surgery like gastric bypass, but they're going to focus on bacterial overgrowth. Okay. Just two things to be aware of. If you get a C. difficile question, pseudomembranous colitis, if they give you two answers, choice A, bacterial overgrowth, choice B, ingestion of spores, you're going to choose ingestion of spores.
Okay.
That's high yield, actually. That can be an annoying one for people. You don't have an absolute bacterial overgrowth in pseudomembranous colitis. It's more just the imbalance, right?
I see.
That's why. Mm-hmm. So you could say C. difficile technically overgrows, but it's just an imbalance. It's not like the absolute amount of bacteria has overgrown. It's just a net overgrowth of C. difficile.